Hi, this is the CMAS Politics Podcast. I am your host, Lance Harris. My guest today will be Scott Harris. He's my brother. He's also an illustrator and author. He has a comic book called The Crime Busters, which will be published in June. His Kickstarter will be available on June 11th. You can preview The Crime Busters and get some more information at his website, which is www.crimebusterscomics.com. You can also follow me daily on Twitter at CMAS Politics and on the web at www.cmaspolitics.com. Now our conversation with Scott Harris, illustrator and author of The Crime Busters. Hope you enjoy it. All right, joining me today is Scott Harris. He is an illustrator and author, and he's here to talk about his latest project, or his upcoming project. It's a comic book called The Crime Busters. I won't say a whole lot about it because I don't know a whole lot about it. I will ask you, Scott, welcome to the CMAS Politics Podcast, this episode not about politics.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, I'm afraid there's not a lot of political content in this issue of The Crime Busters, but so thanks for having me.
All right, well, tell me about the Crime Busters. Where'd you get the concept? Where'd you get the characters? How have you gotten to this point?
There's a couple different answers to that, but basically, when I was a kid, I was really into the young adult books that were like teen detective stories. Trixie Belden was one of my favorite series, The Three Investigators, things like Nancy Drew and The Hardy Boys. I used to collect those and I'd read them. But then when I got a little older, I discovered comic books and sort of went off into comic books for a long time. About 10 years ago, I discovered an old comic book series from the 40s called Boy Comics, and it had a character called Crime Buster, who's a teen detective. There's some superhero elements, like a costume and stuff, but other than that, it was very similar to the stories that I liked growing up. And towards the end of the series, that was sort of made more explicit, where Crime Buster's real name is Chuck Chandler. He went off to college because he wanted to get a degree so he could join the FBI and become like a real detective. And from that point, it was a lot of stories that were like teen adventure stories. You know, they find an abandoned mine or their plane crashes in the Amazon and they have to get out and stuff like that. So it was something that I really liked, and it gave me a lot of sort of nostalgic feelings for that style, but I couldn't find anything in the current comic book marketplace that was similar to that. So I realized if I wanted to read something like that, I'd have to make it myself. And Crime Buster is in the public domain. So what I decided to do is, originally I was just going to do a continuation of his series. So pick up the numbering with number 120 and pick up the continuity right where it left off. The last issue came out in February of 1956. So I just pick right up in 1956 with Chuck at college. And that's essentially what I've done with the Crime Busters. The one big change that I made is that, as I mentioned, the original series was called Boy Comics. And I didn't really want this to be just for boys or about boys like the original series was. One thing that was definitely missing from that original series is the series ran for 14 years, 117 issues. There were basically no recurring female characters. There were women or girls that were important to specific stories, but then they disappear. They weren't important. So I felt like that wasn't really appropriate for what I wanted to write, partially because there's so many classic teen detectives that are girls. It's, you know, Nancy Drew and Trixie Belden, Veronica Mars. There's this really strong tradition of girl detectives. And a lot of the readers of these types of stories are girls and women. So I wanted to have a strong female co-lead, create a character who could be just as important as Chuck Chandler, Crime Buster, and sort of be like a true partner. So I changed the title to The Crime Busters, plural, and I created a character named Trixie Trouble. And this first issue is set in 1956. They're at college, they meet for the first time, and they have to investigate the death of a professor. The police think it's, you know, ruled it a suicide, but they're not so sure. So, you know, then the case takes off from there.
You'd mentioned that the character Chuck Chandler was in the public domain, how does that work? I mean, is he a character that has been passed on through the Boy comics before, you know, the 1950s? Has it always been in the public domain? Is it the sort of thing where after a certain amount of time, no one has the rights to the character? That was one of the questions I was going to ask you, is how do you get the rights to a character like this? And then I guess the follow-up, if you're picking this up in 1956, you know, have any authors, as far as you know, tried to continue or try to resurrect the character previously?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because I just discovered today that there's a new modernized version of Crime Buster, and the first appearance is coming out the same time I'm doing my Kickstarter, which I'll get back to that in a minute. Basically, how it works is that there was a company called Lev Gleason. That was the name of the person who owned the company and was the publisher. They put out comic books in the 40s. There's a guy working for them named Charles Biro, and he wrote and drew the first Crime Buster story. He created Crime Buster in 1942, and he was like the primary creative force at the company. He was the writer behind almost all of their characters and all their titles, and was a sort of an editor and ran everything. A lot of their stories were crime stories, even though Crime Buster is a teenager. Some of them got very gritty before it sort of turned into a teen adventure story at the end. What the company was really known for was crime stories. They had the first crime comic called Crime Does Not Pay, which sold like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies for every month for years. They had a lot of other crime comics like Crime and Punishment. And in the mid-50s, there was a big crackdown on comics. There were Senate hearings because people believed that the content was inappropriate for children and that it was causing juvenile delinquency and stuff. And the main targets were EC, who were famous for their horror stories, and for their crime comics. And so what happened is the comic company industry created this thing called the Comics Code Authority, which was a self-policing agency that was basically censorship that was imposed by the industry itself. The result was a lot of companies went out of business as a result of this big kerfuffle. And Lev Gleason was one of those. They tried to adapt to the code. They tried to shift. That's one of the reasons at the end Crime Buster went off to college and just stopped. He wasn't like fighting gangsters in the city. Now he was, you know, taking science classes at this college, is because they were trying to change their image and survive in this new marketplace. But it didn't work. The company was basically blacklisted by the distributors. They wouldn't distribute the comics. And so the company shut down in 1956. What ended up happening is that they let the copyright and the trademarks to the characters and the titles lapse. So if they hadn't have done that, they could have continued to renew the copyright. You know, companies like DC and Marvel, they were publishing Captain America and Superman at the same time, but because they continued to renew the copyrights and the trademarks, almost all of that material is still copyrighted and trademarked. You can't use that stuff because it's not public domain. But since Lev Gleason went out of business, they decided not to spend the money to continue to keep that up. And as a result, it lapsed into the public domain in the early 60s. Their main other superhero title was called Daredevil. And so Marvel ended up claiming the trademark for the name Daredevil. And that's where the comic book superhero that we know of now as Daredevil came from, is because Stan Lee was a fan of the original Daredevil, grabbed the trademark because he thought it was a cool name, and then used that. But no one ever did that with Crime Buster. So when the series ended in 1956, Crime Buster basically vanished. There have been other characters in comics since then at both Marvel and DC that are called Crime Buster because the trademark has lapsed. Anybody can just do that. But the actual character has only been used once. In the mid-90s, there was a company called AC Comics, and they specialize in Golden Age characters that are in the public domain. So they brought back Crime Buster for a few issues. They published one issue of Crime Buster, Crime Buster number 0. It didn't go anywhere, and so they let that lapse. They had the trademark for a few years as well, starting in 1995 when they first filed, but they let that lapse in 2005. So the character's not under trademark. None of the material is under copyright anymore. So that's where I was when I picked it up. It was kind of a funny coincidence that, you know, my Kickstarter to launch this is going live on June 11. The character hasn't been used by anybody for the last 23 years, basically. And just coincidentally, there's a company that's putting out a new version of Crime Buster, and the first appearance is coming out in June as well. So after 23 years, all of a sudden, it's Crime Buster's moment. So it's interesting. Because it's public domain, all the material is fair game for anybody. Where it could become tricky for me or for them is in the trademark. You can trademark the look of the character, which is a little more difficult, or you can trademark the name. And then if I had the name Crime Buster trademarked, they wouldn't be able to use it, or they could use it, and then I would have to basically take legal action against them because I would be the trademark holder, which would also be true. In this case, it's not really that big of a deal for a few reasons. Since I've decided to call my whole series Crime Busters, plural, because I want it to be equally about Chuck Chandler and about my character Trixie, I don't really refer to him as Crime Buster that much in the stories or on the covers. You know, I call him Chuck Chandler, because I don't want there to be that confusion. And this company, Antarctic Press, that's putting out this new character, they have basically come to the same conclusion that they want to differentiate their version of the character from any other possible version. So their character is actually called Crime Buster 76. The character, his superhero costume is actually his hockey jersey. And so his number is 76. So they're calling their character Crime Buster 76. All of their logos say Crime Buster 76. And the other thing is, their character is actually not Chuck Chandler. They've updated the character. For modern audiences, their version of Crime Buster is present day, a young, I think African-American female who is, instead of a hockey player, she's a field hockey player. And so they're using the name Crime Buster. They're using the costume and the basic sort of basic idea, but it's a completely different take on things. Whereas my version, I'm actually picking up the continuity from the original series. So I'm starting the numbering with 120 because the last issue was 119 that they published. I'm keeping it in period in 1956. It's Chuck. It's the other supporting characters from his college days. And they're not using any of that stuff. It's basically just the name, the look, and the basic concept. So there's very little overlap. And that's the sort of thing that you can do with the public domain characters. It's kind of like anybody can do their own version of Sherlock Holmes because he's in the public domain. Right. It's this sort of thing. Just like, you know, there's the TV version of Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch, and then at the same time there's a movie version with Robert Downey Jr. That's basically what's happening here. Yeah, so, you know, I had definitely a few tense moments while I was trying to figure out what they were doing, but once I realized how different they were, I don't think it'll be an issue. I have applied for trademark for the Crime Busters for comic book purposes, just for a little extra protection. But yeah, the copyright stuff, everyone's free and clear to do whatever they want. It's the trademarks that get tricky. Like, for instance, if you've seen the advertisements for the movie Shazam, mm-hmm. that just came out in April or March, there was also the Marvel movie Captain Marvel. Both of those characters were named Captain Marvel, but because the trademark lapsed in the 50s, even though DC had the rights to the character named Captain Marvel, Marvel had the rights to the name Captain Marvel. And so DC eventually changed the name of their character to Shazam because they weren't able to market their own character on comic books. They couldn't call him Captain Marvel in the comics. So that's basically how that works.
Did you find this out about the other comic? Was it just by chance? Have you been in communication with them to know that you're not overlapping on anything? Or
no, I haven't been in communication with them. I just found out, and it was just someone on Facebook that is aware of my project saw the advertisement for this. I've thought about reaching out to them, but I think I'd rather just do my own thing, particularly because of potential trademark issues. Like, for instance, if I were to say, hey, everyone, check out this other version of Crime Buster, it could be a little dicey in terms of them feeling like I'm promoting my own version using theirs. And that's where trademark issues are actually come into play. They're not as small as I am because I'm doing everything myself. The whole book is all me and I'm publishing it myself. This is an established independent company called Antarctic Press. They've been doing comics for 30 years. But they are also a very small organization. They do have a bit of a reputation for sometimes being a little spiky. So I just, I don't think there's any overlap. So I just prefer not to even risk someone over there, like getting in a bunch over nothing.
So you mentioned new character, Trixie Trouble.
Yes.
That you wanted to add because you wanted to bring a woman into the story who was an equal or a partner with Chuck Chandler, but you're also going to have it set in 1956. I mean, so are you bringing 21st century thoughts and ideas of gender? Are they stuck in the 50s in the sense that their relationship is consistent with what you stereotypically you'd think of a, you know, male-female relationship in the mid-50s is? How are you handling how that character works?
There's definitely going to be some more modern treatment of the way the characters interact. That is going to play out some in the stories. Chuck is, you know, he's sort of a straight ahead Boy Scout. He has a very strong internal sense of what's right and what's wrong. And so he's always very confident in the way he acts. And as a result, he doesn't always he's not very introspective. He doesn't necessarily question assumptions, right? So, but Trixie does. And so it's going to play out gently because this is, you know, it's mostly a fun action story like in a Scooby-Doo sort of tradition. So this isn't a focus of anything, but there's going to be times for sure when he's going to be sort of acting in sort of traditional roles like, you know, I need to protect you, you know, this is too dangerous for you, this sort of thing. And she's going to be sort of like explaining to him forcefully that he's, you know, sort of being a dunderhead. It's not something that I want to have as the focus of the story, but it's something that I've definitely taken into consideration. I mean, one thing is that there's a certain cultural norm from the 50s, but there were also people living at the time that were outside of the norm, you know, who had more modern ideas. And so I don't think it's really a stretch. Trixie's roommate and best friend, Vera, is going to be a character. She's not in the first issue very much, but in future issues, she's more to do, more of a spotlight. And she's an African-American female. And so it's definitely something I've been thinking about in terms of how to treat the character, given that it's in the 1950s. And basically, it's not something that's going to come up unless a specific plot requires it to come up as a plot point. So, you know, there's not really a message about this per se, but there's definitely going to be some sort of modern treatment of the characters, even though they're in a sort of a 50s setting.
Is there a geographical element? I mean, where is the thing set? Is that going to be part of the storyline? Or because certainly,
yeah, it is.
You're talking about, not to cut you off, you're talking about bringing in an African-American character. You know, there's a difference between you know, college students in the North or out West or in down South or.
Yeah. So it's in New York. It's set in New York State. In the comics, it's kind of a little unclear as to where Curtis Tech, the school is, but it seems from the context that it's probably lower, you know, New York. So I have an idea in my head where it is, you know, maybe 45 minutes to an hour, maybe an hour north of New York City. Chuck's original stories were all set in New York City. So he's got a strong sort of New York background. And this is something that's also going to play out where Chuck is sort of, he's a city guy, whereas Trixie is from rural New York. You know, one of the inspirations obviously is Trixie Belden, which I've named the character Trixie sort of as an homage. And the character Trixie Belden grew up, she's situated in sort of horse country, like just north of New York City, like the Hudson River Valley, basically.
Right.
And so there's going to be that dynamic between the two where she's sort of rural, has a rural background. There's going to be stories later on where they go into New York City further along where they get to the summer break between school years. Then we're going to have some stories where they go sort of outside the area.
So I know I suggested in the open that there wasn't this wasn't much about politics, but being set in the 50s, and you had mentioned that Chuck was going to college because he wants to go into the FBI. Do you anticipate that any of the storylines will have to do about things like the Cold War, or, I mean, you're talking about the 50s, you know, fighting communism, those kinds of things that were happening from a political standpoint during that time frame?
Yeah, there'll be some that touch on that sort of thing. Again, it's as sort of like a Scooby-Doo sort of adventure thing. It's not going to be like a serious political discussion. But yeah, it's definitely going to come up. One thing that I've had to deal with is that it is the sliding timeline that most comic books have. Crime Buster Chuck Chandler debuted in 1942, and at that time, he's like maybe 14 years old. At the end of the series, 14 years later in real time, he's like 18 years old at college. So in his origin story is that his parents were activists at the beginning of World War II who were murdered by a Nazi spy. This story doesn't make any sense if we have like a fixed timeline where if Chuck is, you know, let's say he's 19 at the beginning of this issue in the fall of 1956, and his parents were killed when he was 14. They really should be getting killed in 1951. Right. So Nazi Germany is not really a concern at that point. So this is something where I've had to take several things into account, and one of them is basically his backstory. I've been vague about his parents' death in that it's just mentioned that enemy agents kill him. But realistically, it would have to be connected to the Korean War, and they would probably be communist agents. Or something, you know, where they were in Europe and there was something to do with the Iron Curtain. When appropriate, there's going to be historical events that come into play. Nothing immediate, because, again, I'm starting in the fall of 1956. But for instance, you know, I hope the series continues long enough for me to get some stories that I want to do. For instance, in the fall of 1957, which are going to have some political, some content. There's going to be some stuff about Little Rock, mm-hmm. but also I've got a specific story that I want to tell, and I haven't quite figured out how I'm going to do this, but I find it very interesting that as a storyteller, the announcement that the Brooklyn Dodgers were leaving New York City
right.
Was only 2 days from Sputnik crossing over. And so I want to have a story that ties the relocation of the Brooklyn Dodgers to Sputnik. And when I do that story, there's definitely going to be a communist element. But that's the sort of story that I'm doing.
Are the Brooklyn Dodgers or sports in general a big part of Chuck's life?
In the original series, he was, you know, since it was boy comics, it was all about things boys like. In addition to fighting crime, he was constantly getting involved in stuff with sports. A lot of boxing, like boxing matches being rigged, but also a lot of basketball, some baseball, a lot of hockey. You know, he wears a hockey uniform as his outfit. So his mentor, who is the FBI regional director, Louver, is always bringing him to see the World Series, or they're going to the Stanley Cup playoffs or whatever. There's definitely like a sports element to it, and it's never explicitly stated who he supports, but he just feels like a Brooklyn Dodgers fan to me.
Will we get to see Jackie Robinson or any other characters or cameos?
Chuck's mentor is the FBI director, and his name is Jay Louver. It's clearly supposed right. to be Edgar Hoover, but luckily they didn't give him that name. So with the benefit of hindsight, I'm able to significantly change that character.
Now, you've tried to pitch ideas to publishers before, so why did you decide on self-publishing the Crime Busters?
Yeah, the submission process for like big publishers like Marvel, DC, that sort of thing, is nearly impossible. If you just blindly like send them an unsolicited thing, it goes in the slush pile, and chances are they're never going to read it. I forget, one of those companies actually has a policy they just don't even read them. But it's almost impossible. Basically, what you have to do if you're going to break these days, if you're going to break into comics, is you have to get published in order to get published. So you're gonna have to self-publish or have some other way to get in print with all the small companies, and then you can present your already published work to the larger companies because they won't even consider doing stuff. Back in the 90s, I submitted stuff to DC and Marvel. I didn't get too far, you know. There was a couple, one proposal in particular at Vertigo that I got some traction with, and I had some back and forth with the editors, but that's no longer something you can really do. But luckily, it's much easier to self-publish now than it's ever been before. I'm first and foremost a writer, so I always wanted, the stumbling block for me was not feeling like I couldn't afford an artist.
Right.
I eventually decided to just draw it myself, which means a lot more effort, but saves me a lot of money.
How do you self-publish something like this?
Well, there's a few different avenues. What I'm doing is I'm going through Kickstarter. There's different methods people have, but basically, yes. One of the main reasons it's so much easier to do now is because of the internet. And partially that's because it's easier to get things published through modern technology. Print on demand is a huge game changer in terms of the cost of printing a comic. If you wanted to print a comic in the 80s, you'd have to go to a printing press and you'd have to pay thousands of dollars because they'd need to make the plates and do a print run, and they'd only do it if you have a minimum of X number of copies. With print on demand, if you want to just print one copy of your comic, you can do it. And so you can tailor your order size to your readership size. And so you don't have to lay out thousands of dollars to create a comic book. You can spend $50 to print a few copies, or you can spend a couple $100 to make 100 copies or something. Obviously, you know, if you're doing it at scale, it's much cheaper to do an offset traditional print run than print on demand, but it makes it much easier to actually get the physical product. The internet part is that it's vastly easier now to find an audience for your comic. It doesn't matter if you make a comic if nobody knows about it or knows, you know, that it exists. So the internet allows you to get an audience, to create a fan base much, much easier than you used to do. The traditional comic book market is in the dumps and has been for quite a long time, and it's just getting worse. And that's because, I won't get into all of it, basically they have these systems in place where they have this direct market where they have specialty comic book stores. So if you want comics, you have to go to a comic book store, and there's one distributor that sells all the comics of the comic book stores. And nobody's going to see your comics except the people that are going to the comic book stores. Right. So it's a constantly shrinking circular market. On the internet, though, you can market it to everybody. It doesn't have to be people that are going to the comic book store. It can be anybody that goes online. And what people will have done is they create a fan base that's not based on the comic store and it's not based on the region they're in. It's international. You can use Facebook ads, and you can do other kind of viral marketing on Instagram and Twitter and different social medias to make people aware of it, drive them to your website so that they get the samples or so they see your comic. And then you can you can contact them directly through a mailing list and say, I'm putting out this new comic. Some people are digital only. They don't even print the comics. They just have the stuff uploaded, and that removes 90% of the costs of doing the comic, because you don't have to do any of the printing costs, you don't have to do any shipping costs. Once you've made the comic, you can click a button and email it to them. And so there's people who have dedicated fan bases that are centered just on them as a creator, and they never have to physically publish anything. They can just directly interact with their fans. With Kickstarter, the way I'm doing it is I don't have that fan base yet, because this is the first thing I've ever done. And so part of my reason for going to Kickstarter is that it's like a coming out party. It's to announce that this exists.
Right.
It's an event. I can then do Facebook ads and social media stuff around the launch. And then with Kickstarter, the idea is that what a lot of comic book people do is they basically use Kickstarter as a way to get the orders for their physical comics. So like, if you don't want to go through the Diamond, the distributor, and you don't want to be reliant on the comic book store system, with Kickstarter, you can directly sell the comics to your audience. So if I go there and I say, okay, I need $500 to make a comic book. And basically, you know, in Kickstarter, people will pledge the money to support you. And the reward is the comic book. So you're basically getting orders for the comic book. And then when you get, you get $10 for a comic book and you're looking for $500, you get 50 people there, you're funded. And then you can go to your on-demand people and print 50 issues. And there you are. You don't have any waste because you haven't, you know, printed too many copies that you can't sell. You already have the money in hand. They're pre-sold. Yeah, it basically just circumvents the whole traditional comic book system.
Are comic book fans still looking for a physical copy they can hold in their hands and keep as collectibles? Or is the comic industry following newspapers and magazines toward more digital formats?
It's a little bit of both. And it's also a little bit age dependent. Older readers are much more likely to be collectors because they grew up with the physical comics. Younger readers are more likely to be readers where they'll buy it digitally. But there's definitely still a market for the physical. What a lot of, even the digital people, digital creators, a lot of them will eventually do a collection, a physical, like a hardcover or trade collection of their online strips, because people want to have the physical version of things. It's very common for even very, very successful online creators to run Kickstarters so that you're like, here's all the stories that you've already read, but now it's in a book form, so you can have that. And so it depends. There's also a lot of readers who, comic book readers, who prefer reading it physically. It's a different reading experience than reading a comic book on a tablet or something. There's definitely a subset of readers who just prefer it that way. It's very difficult to say how much, because as I mentioned, like, Diamond is the only distributor. They released their sales figures of how many physical copies that they've sent to the stores, but the different publishers do not release their sales figures for their digital copies. It's almost impossible to guess how many copies of comics are actually being sold and what the breakdown is between physical and digital. The market for regular individual issues of physical comic books is definitely shrinking at the same time that the comics as a medium, I think, is actually growing, but it's just spreading out into a lot of different formats. And so it's decentralizing itself. As the traditional industry shrinks on itself, people are going outside of that to find other avenues. And so there's like a huge boom in create like self-publishing.
Do you do all the artwork and the rest of it by hand, or are you using digital products now?
Program, I do it all digitally. There's a program called, it used to be called Manga Studio, but now it's called Clip Studio Paint. It's kind of like Photoshop, except it's specifically designed for comic books.
Okay.
It's got tools where you can draw the panels. There's tools where it'll just do word balloons. And it's got a 3D modeler. So if you're looking at a certain angle and you need your characters to be at a certain angle, you can actually position your 3D models so you know exactly. You can. It's pretty complicated, but if you get good at it, you can change where the light source is so that you can see exactly where the shadows need to be on all the characters from that specific angle. Mm-hmm. A little bit more than I do, because my art is a simpler, more cartoony style, sort of like Archie Comics.
Right.
But there's a lot of functionality. There are benefits to doing things by hand, like a traditional drawing on a piece of paper. And the main benefit really is in the secondary market, because people that read your comic will pay money for the original art. As an artist, you'll create like a secondary income stream. You know, like if I was doing it by hand for my Kickstarter, I could have rewards of like you can buy the original pages. And that's something I can't do because it's digital.
To close, why don't you let people know how they can pop onto the Kickstarter, where they can find more information? I know you've got a website. And
yeah, so the website's crimebustercomics.com. And if you go there, you can read a six-page preview, the first six pages of the first issue. There's bios of all the characters. There's like an ongoing blog where I go into detail about what the whole creative process of making the comic. If you go there, you'll also want to go to sign up for the newsletter. It allows me to contact people directly who are interested in it. You can also go to the Facebook group. If you look for the Crime Busters on Facebook, you'll find it. The thing is that Facebook basically throttles your audience stream. So if I say I have 25 people that have liked or follow the Crime Busters Facebook page, when I post something on there, only between 12 and 15 of them actually see the post, because Facebook wants me to pay to boost the posts to everybody. If you sign up for the newsletter, I can email you directly and you'll be assured of getting the updates on my comic. Whereas if you're on Facebook, for instance, you may not see it even when I'm doing posts. On Twitter, I'm at T Crime Busters. Going to the website and signing up for the mailing list is the easiest way to keep in touch. The Kickstarter is going to launch on June 11. It's going to run for 3 weeks. You know, my goal is $500. I'm hoping to get 8. If I do that, I can make the comic a little bit bigger. I've got like a 4-page extra bonus story I want to put in there. And that will cover the costs of printing the comic and mailing it out to everybody and some other cool rewards that I have. So yeah, that's it.
When do you think people who are interested in the comic would start to receive them?
It's a good question. I'm not entirely sure, because it's going to depend on how long the printer takes to print them. So the Kickstarter is actually going to end, I think, on July 2nd or July 3rd. The comic's all done. It's all ready to go. A lot of Kickstarters, you're paying to have the comic book created. And so when you pledge for something on Kickstarter, you might not get it for a year. That's not the case here. It's all done. I'm hoping to have in hand a sample copy before the Kickstarter even launches. I don't know how long it's going to take them to print it. I think it's going to be between 2 and 4 weeks. So the time frame that I have on the Kickstarter is that I expect to receive the books in August and send them out in September. I'm hoping to actually get them in August and send them out in August. So best case, I think people will get them at the end of August. I've built in an extra month time just in case, so it might not be till the end of September. I wouldn't expect it to be longer than that, but this is the first time I've done this, so there's always complications you can't foresee. But I would think September is a reasonable time to get it in hand. And when people pledge, in addition to the physical comic, everybody is also going to get the digital PDF version. And that's something you'll receive as soon as the Kickstarter is done. You know, within the first week, I'll be emailing copies of the PDF to anybody who is back to the project.
I certainly wish you the best of luck, obviously. Because if I were to wish you bad luck, that would be uncomfortable.
Rude. Yeah. It'd be really, really rude, yeah.
Again, I've been talking with Scott Harris. He's an author and illustrator. He's created the Crime Busters comic book that is going to be coming out later on this summer, Kickstarter, starting on the 11th of June. And you can find information about that at crimebusters.com. I'm Lance Harris. This is the CMAS Politics Podcast. Thanks for joining us. You can find me on Twitter at CMAS Politics. On the web at www.cmaspolitics.com and on any of your favorite podcast platforms.
We'll be right back.